The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from USA Today, the Associated Press, and the Religion News Service. First of all, an article published by USA Today on July the 3rd, written by Julia Gomez and entitled, First Millennial Saint Approved by Cardinals. Blessed Carlo Acutis, a teen who died from cancer, is the first millennial to be canonized as a saint. He was an ordinary boy, a boy who lived his childhood and youth between family, school, and the games children play, said Bishop of Assisi, Domenico Sorrentino. On Monday, the College of Cardinals voted for the teen's canonization, reports the Catholic News Agency, and in 2025 he will be declared a saint. Acutis then lived a life of faith that was nurtured until it reached a peak that now makes him stand out in the eyes of the Church and the world as a saint who will soon be proclaimed, he added. Two medical miracles have already been attributed to the teen, who was known as God's influencer. Who was Acutis? Acutis was an Italian teen who used his tech skills to spread the Catholic faith. He was born on May the 3rd, 1991, in London, and died on October 12, 2006, in Italy, after battling leukemia, reports Vatican News. Before his death, he considered becoming a priest, reports WJBF. The teen's beatification took place in 2020, meaning the Pope declared the teen attained the blessedness of heaven, and Acutis was given the title of blessed. Miracles attributed to blessed Carlo Acutis. A student attending a university in Florence fell off her bike and suffered severe head trauma and required craniotomy surgery that had a low chance of survival. However, her miraculous recovery is attributed to Acutis, reports Vatican News. The student's mother made the pilgrimage to visit Acutis' tomb and leave a note. The same day, her daughter started to breathe spontaneously. The day after, she began to move and regain some of her speech. 10 days later, a CAT scan showed her brain hemorrhage had disappeared. What is a saint? Saints are persons in heaven who were officially canonized, or not, who did one of the following, according to the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops: lived heroically virtuous lives, offered their life to others, died for their faith. All saints must have lived lives worthy of imitation. Now, an article published by the Associated Press on July 7 and written by Joseph Wilson, entitled Church Bells Speak Language in Spain Thanks to Effort to Recover the Lost Language of Ringing by Hand. Juanet, Spain. Xavier Palas plants his feet on the belfry floor, grips the rope, and with one tug fills the lush Spanish valley below with the reverberating peal of a church bell. Clang, clong, clang, clong, clang, clong. The swinging bronze bell resonates with each strike of the clapper, filling the small stone tower with an undulating hum. Once Palas finishes his peals, the metallic melody fades to stillness. Silence returns to the tower, giving the valley's soundscape back to the bird songs and rooster crows. For most, church bells are just a quaint bit of automated background noise, but Palas and his 18 students in the Val Faldenbaugh School of Bell Ringers are trying to change that by resuscitating the dwindling art of tolling and communicating by hand. The shift to mechanical tolling devices over the past century has flattened the bell's dynamic songs and muted their messaging power, said Palas, the school's founder and director. If played with know-how, the sounding of church bells in various sequences, tones, and rhythms can signal the time for rejoicing or mourning and when to run to the aid of a neighbor in need. For centuries, the tolling of church bells was our most important communication method, said Paulus, standing inside the belfry which doubles as his classroom. Machines cannot reproduce the richness of the sounds that we used to hear, so there's been a simplification and unification of bell ringing. The language has been lost little by little until now, when we are finally recognizing its worth. Before newspapers, radios, telephones, television, and the internet, it was bell ringing that transmitted important information. A physically demanding job that required long hours and complete dedication, to be a bell ringer was to be a human clock and the public loudspeaker. While manual church bell ringing has persisted in Eastern Orthodox countries, it has largely been replaced by bell ringing systems in Catholic and Protestant churches in Western Europe. Many of Spain's church bell towers that were automatized in the 1990s and 80s are in a dire state, said Paulus, who witnessed widespread problems while researching the belfries of Garrocha, a county in northeast Catalonia. The rural area is known for its verdant hills, dormant volcanoes, and picturesque villages where most people speak Catalan before Spanish. His research included the 12th century Saint Roma Church in Joanets, a tiny village about 2 hours north of Barcelona, where Paulus has spent the past 10 months teaching the inaugural class one Saturday a month. Since the last generation of bell ringers had died off, the only thing to do was to train new ones in how to toll the bells. And that's where the idea of the school was born, Paulus said. The initiative comes 2 years after UNESCO added manual bell ringing in Spain to its compendium of humanity's intangible cultural heritage. UNESCO described how the bells had knitted together communities even before they were functioning modern states. The first thing we have to do is rediscover the bells. That is why this school is so important, said Roman Gené Capdevila, president of Catalonia's Bell Ringers Brotherhood. There's so many ways to ring a bell. What we need are bell ringers. The bell ringing course, officially recognized by the ISCREB Theology School in Barcelona, finished last week with a demonstration by the class. All drawn to the allure of the banging bells, the students were men and women with diverse professional backgrounds ranging from engineering to teaching. One was in his 20s. Several were retirees. They spent the past few months researching old chiming sequences, documenting their origins, and learning to play them. That ethnographic task meant students had to search out old bell ringers or their family members to record what they knew. Rosa Sari jumped at the chance to reconnect with her childhood by recovering and playing the chiming sequence that had sounded in her grandfather's village when he was baptized. The bells formed a part of my life, said Sari, who now works in artificial intelligence. She missed their constancy while studying for her computing doctorate in Boston, where she heard none. When I visited my family, I began to associate the sound of church bells with being back home. The students took turns tolling sequences for everything from calls to Easter Mass, bad weather warnings, help for fighting a fire, to orders for the village militia. They also could tell workers to get back to reaping wheat or housewives when the fresh fish was coming to market and even how much it cost. Many of the ringers wore earplugs or headphones to muffle the deafening peals. The students told a gamut of death announcements that could specify gender and social class. Juan Carlos Usona and two others tolled for the death of a woman. That meant swinging the largest bell at 429 kilos, or 945 pounds. It still had a clapper secured in the traditional method of using a dried skin of an ox penis. Osona, who paints church murals, also performed a complex sequence with all four of Belfry's bells that required him to sit in a chair with ropes looped around his hands and feet. Whew. It's an emotional experience. You feel your blood pumping. You feel the strength and how you are communicating with everyone in earshot, he said. For me, it is an honor. It's a way to honor both humans and God. The hesitation, the variation in the strength of each toll, and these details, and sometimes mistakes, the listener can hear the creator of the sound. The automated hammer will always be mathematically precise, Osana said. There is emotion in the human touch. There is a human element. What might seem like a quixotic mission has so far had a promising start. While admitting that his dream of having a bell ringer for every tower is utopian, Paula said he has a full class lined up for the fall and some 60 more people on a waiting list. Many of his graduating pupils, including Sari and Osana, hope to continue playing at their local parishes or help convert their belfries into systems that allow manual ringing. Paulus believes that a recovery of bell ringing in a neighborhood or town's life could help strengthen communities in this dizzying age of technological, economic, and political change. This is a means of communication that reaches everyone inside a local community and can help it come together at concrete moments, Paulus said. That can include a death in the community or the celebration of a holiday. It can help mark the rituals that we need. Now an article published by the Associated Press on July 5, written by Nicole Winfield. Vatican excommunicates a former ambassador to the United States and declares him guilty of schism. Rome. The Vatican on Friday excommunicated its former ambassador to Washington after finding him guilty of schism, an inevitable outcome for Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigana. The conservative had become one of Pope Francis's most ardent critics and a symbol of the polarized Catholic Church in the United States and beyond. While once enjoying support in the Vatican and U.S. church hierarchies, the Italian archbishop alienated many as he developed a fringe following while delving deeper into conspiracy theories on everything, from the coronavirus pandemic to what he called the Great Reset and Russia's war in Ukraine. The Vatican's doctrine office announced the penalty after a meeting of its members on Thursday and informed Vigana of its decision on Friday. It cited Vigana's public refusal to recognize and submit to the Supreme Pontiff, his rejection of communion with the members of the Church subject to him, and of the legitimacy and magisterial authority of the Second Vatican Council. The excommunication, which Vigana incurred automatically with his positions, means he is formally outside communion with the Church and cannot celebrate or receive its sacraments. The crime of schism occurs when someone withdraws submission to the Pope or from the communion of Catholics who were subject to him. Unlike defrocking, a punitive measure that makes a priest a layman again, excommunication is considered a medicinal penalty and is declared in hope those who incurred it would repent and come back into communion. If that happens, the Holy See can lift the penalty. Schisms, which have been regular in the Church's 2,000-year history, are considered particularly dangerous as they threaten the unity of the Church. Vigana's dire pronunciations about the current state of the Church, amplified on Catholic social media and by ideologically friendly bloggers on both sides of the Atlantic, were an exaggerated version of the chasm between U.S. ultra-conservatives and Francis. And while Vigana enjoyed mainstream support among bishops early in his career, many quietly distanced themselves as his ideas became more extreme. The Italian prelate, who has not been seen publicly since before 2018, knew the schism declaration was coming after the Vatican informed him of the penal process launched against him last month. He defiantly called it an honor and refused to appear in person or defend himself or submit a written defense. On June 20, Vigana issued a lengthy public statement refusing to recognize the authority of the Vatican's doctrinal office that claims to judge me, nor of its prefect, nor of the one who appointed him. He did not directly respond to the schism declaration on Friday on X, his usual forum. Shortly before the Vatican decree was made public, he announced he would be celebrating a Mass on Friday for those who have been supporting him and asked for donations. Vigana burst onto the public scene in 2012 during the first so-called VatiLeaks scandal, when Pope Benedict XVI's butler leaked the pontiff's private papers to an Italian journalist to try to draw attention to corruption in the Holy See. In some of the leaked letters, Vigana, then the number two in the Vatican City State Administration, begged the Pope not to be transferred after exposing corruption in the awarding of Vatican contracts that cost the Holy See millions of euros. The entreaties did not work. By the time the letters were published, Vigana was appointed the Vatican's ambassador to the U.S., a prestigious post, but one that took him far from Rome and out of the running to one day be a cardinal. Vigana reappeared on the scene during Francis's 2015 visit to the U.S., which as nuncio he helped organize. Everything was going fine until Vigana arranged for Kim Davis, a Kentucky clerk at the center of the U.S. gay marriage debate, to be present at the Vatican residence to greet Francis, along with many other people. After the visit, Davis and her lawyers claimed the encounter with Francis amounted to an affirmation of her cause, denying marriage licenses to same-sex couples. The Vatican later turned the tables on Davis' claim, saying she had merely been among a group of well-wishers, but that the only private audience Francis had in Washington was with a small group of people that included a gay couple. But Vigana's deception in inviting Davis to meet the Pope put the prelate and the pontiff on a collision course that exploded in August 2018. At the time, the U.S. Church was reeling from a new chapter in its clergy sex abuse scandal. One of the most senior U.S. churchmen, Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, was accused of molesting a minor, and a Pennsylvania grand jury issued a devastating investigation into decades of abuse and cover-up. As Francis was wrapping up a tense visit to Ireland, Vigana published an 11-page screed accusing him and a long string of U.S. and Vatican officials of covering for McCarrick. Specifically, Vigana accused Francis of rehabilitating McCarrick from sanctions imposed by Pope Benedict, and called on him to resign, accusations that created the greatest crisis of Francis' then-young pontificate. Francis quickly authorized an in-house investigation into McCarrick. The report, released in 2020, confirmed that a generation of church officials, including Pope John Paul II, had turned a blind eye to McCarrick's misconduct. It largely spared Francis, who eventually defrocked the churchman. But the report also faulted Vigana for not looking into new claims against McCarrick or enforcing Vatican restrictions on him when specifically ordered to do so by the Vatican. At that point, Vigana's claims against Francis became more unhinged, endorsing conspiracy theories about the coronavirus vaccines, appearing at far-right U.S. political rallies via video, backing Russia in its war on Ukraine, and eventually refusing to recognize Francis as Pope. Massimo Fagioli, a theologian at Villanova University, said while a good number of U.S. bishops vouched for Vigano's integrity when he first made his claims about McCarrick in 2018, his declarations in the ensuing years led some of them to more prudent positions. In an essay in the French daily Le Croix, Fagioli also noted that Vigano had had a seeming unintended effect of mainstreaming another schismatic group, the Society of St. Pius X, which also rejects the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, the 1960s meetings that modernized the Church. However, the society known as SSPX, founded by the late French Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre in 1969, distanced itself from Vigano and his rejection of the legitimacy of Francis' pontificate, saying, "They have not ventured down that perilous road." Vigano's positions made Lefebvre and the SSPX look like right-of-center Catholics and not like the extreme traditionalists they actually are, Fagioli said. This says something about the ground shifting under the feet of Vatican II Catholics. Our last article is an opinion piece published by the Religion News Service on July 3 and written by Russ Ewell, who is the executive minister of the Bay Area Christian Church, entitled, "The Americans with Disabilities Act is Still Doing Its Work. Churches Should Join In." My firstborn son arrived in 1991, just a year after the Americans with Disabilities Act became law. He was diagnosed with Down syndrome at birth and needed physical therapy at just 3 months of age to make sure he would crawl. He's had to fight to overcome a lot as he's grown into the young man he is today. But conversations with parents from before the ADA suggest that my spouse and I have been comparatively blessed. Prior to the ADA, students with special needs or disabilities were effectively warehoused by many public school systems. Parents had little recourse if they felt their child was being treated poorly, and their children often were. Meanwhile, adults with disabilities routinely encountered discrimination at work and were often unable to visit restaurants, schools, churches, and the like, simply because they were not physically able to get up the stairs or through the door. 34 years ago, the ADA helped change that. On July 26, 1990, people in institutions were legally required to recognize those with disabilities or special needs for what they were, people. It began to teach the American public to respect and accommodate everyone, whether typical or atypical. This victory didn't come out of nowhere. It was the result of decades of tireless, often thankless work on the part of those with disabilities and special needs. They and their families, friends, and communities helped make the ADA possible. The ADA's establishment of physical access and prohibition of discrimination are essential if those with special needs or disabilities are ever to know justice. But they cannot flourish unless we fully embrace the spirit of the law. They cannot fully thrive without social and spiritual accessibility. We have to learn to live and strive for them, not just get against discrimination or physical impediments. The Church has a particularly important role to play in this work. So far, even as physical accessibility issues continue to fall away, cruel prejudice and other soft obstacles to inclusion remain widespread. Christians can and should lead in the advocacy for people with disabilities and for their full inclusion as equals in our society. Consider the biblical mandate to look after the poor. Many Christians stop there, concluding that the mandate is straightforwardly about the work of alleviating physical poverty. This is important work, without a doubt, but Jesus spent an incredible amount of time with people with disabilities. Alleviating poverty isn't just about addressing material lack where it's found. It's about finding, loving, and uplifting the people who found themselves marginalized by the rest of the world. The church has a chance to build powerful models of immersive, transformative inclusion of people with disabilities for the rest of the world to adopt and improve. At Bay Area Christian Church in Northern California, where I'm a pastor, we've made our buildings and grounds physically accessible and offer inclusive spaces for those with sensory issues. While this is important, true inclusion goes beyond the physical and permeates the culture. We have social and educational programs intended to fully integrate anyone with any need or ability into the life of the church. We operate inclusive sports and activities across our communities where kids with special needs can participate alongside their typical peers. And our desire is to help other churches do the same. This isn't heroism. It's no more than what Jesus asked us to do. Jesus didn't just heal the leper, after all. He touched the leper. He loved the leper. And this is precisely where Christians are called to follow him. Frankly, it's also the sort of behavior that would make us a lot better off as a society if taken up on a large scale. Of course, there are other reasons for the church to push hard on inclusivity, both within and without its own walls. A more inclusive church is a more just, more compassionate, more honest church, and one more likely to appeal to an increasingly skeptical population. It's more likely to attract and retain talented young people who have a strong leaning to pursue justice and equality. We must remember that the ADA is the beginning, not the end. Those with disabilities and their advocates fought to pave the way for their rights. They started the work. We have to help them finish it. It's up to all of us to make sure all the people with disabilities experience greater and holistic inclusivity in our world. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News, so be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.